All right, good morning.
Good morning.
I think we left off last time with talking about Bethlehem, church nativity, all that kind of good stuff, right? So today we'll concentrate on the area, Jerusalem and around Jerusalem. We'll see how far we get. If we don't make it to Masada, I'm going to skip over Masada today and do Mount of Olives if we have time. But Masada, you can Google it. But just so you know, that's Herod's fortress near the Dead Sea. We will be going there. It's an amazing story of the last stand of the Jews when the Romans were destroying Jerusalem and etc. You'll hear about it when you're there. If you're not able to go, read up on that. It really is one of the most incredible stories you'll ever hear in your life. So, but let's get to Jerusalem. Now, on day six, we go into the old city. We see the Pool of Bethesda, the Chapel of Flagellation, places like that. So I'll point some of those things out to you on the map when we get to it. Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Via Dolorosa, some of these things, the Wailing Wall, etc. We'll all be part of that. So it'll be a really hectic day. And this is where you will really notice the crowd. It just gets super, super crowded. Because this is where everybody wants to go, right, these holy places in and around Jerusalem. So just a little bit of background on Jerusalem itself. We know that there is a story about Abraham. When he fights the battle, do you remember that story? He joins with the king of Sodom, and they're fighting these other kings, and that's when he rescues his nephew Lot. Right, and then on the field of battle comes this really strange character named Melchizedek, who is priest and king of Salem, it says. And they kind of make a pact there on the battlefield, and Melchizedek brings bread and wine, and you know Abraham reinforces his promise to God, etc. So he's noted that's the first time we really hear about Jerusalem in the Old Testament, is that that's where Melchizedek comes from. Yes. Genesis 14. Melchizedek is also mentioned in the Psalms. I forget which one. Sorry about that. And in the book of Hebrews, chapter 7. Some we won't get into it. We just finished the study of Abraham in here. But we talked about Melchizedek a lot in that class. So he may be a pre-incarnated Jesus, et cetera, but very interesting character. All right, so when Moses leads the children of Israel out of Egypt, you remember the story, Moses doesn't make it across the Jordan River into the Promised Land, so Joshua picks that up, and Joshua leads them into the Promised Land, and the whole book of Joshua and Judges is about conquering that area. So this lasts for quite a while, and then around 1050 B.C., in Judges, we hear the people are saying, how come we don't have a king? We want a king. Everybody else has a king. Why don't we have a king? And God says, I'm your king. So that's not good enough. So that's when Saul becomes king. Even though Samuel keeps saying, you're going to regret this. And Saul does go a little nuts on us. So you know the story of David, right? He was anointed king as a child. And then eventually he defeats Goliath, all that kind of stuff. And he becomes the king in Israel after Saul. This is around 1000 B.C. And he takes the Canaanite city of Jerusalem as his capital. And there's a reference in there where he actually calls it the city of Zion. It's known as the city of Zion by the pagans who live there. So we've heard of Mount Zion, all this kind of stuff, right, over and over again. Mount Zion is a hill in Jerusalem. But that was the name of the community that was there. David reclaims it as Jerusalem, and he says he brings the Ark of the Covenant that they've been toting around with them everywhere, right, and wants to build a house of God there. And because of his sin with Bathsheba, God says, you're not going to be the one to build my house, but your son will be. So Solomon gets to build the temple there. All right, so what if you look at your map, you see the temple on the eastern side of the city? And I'm sorry that this is kind of small to see, but You can see the word temple there. So it's a pretty big area. It gets expanded a lot under Herod. But here's how it kind of works. This is Mount Moriah. So this is kind of a hill in Jerusalem that the temple is built upon. Moriah is the name of the mountain that Abraham took Isaac on to sacrifice him. Right? So it becomes later the place where Jesus is crucified. Right? So there's that connection all the way back to Abraham. So what Solomon does in building the temple is he basically builds a retaining wall around Mount Moriah. And just as this is just north of what was then known as the City of David, and those who are going will see the City of David is not very big. And he fills it in, right? So he puts a kind of retaining wall around it and fills it in, so he puts it up high, and just he's putting in fill dirt, etc. And then he builds a temple on top of that. So you're aware of the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, the one wall that's remaining. That's not a wall of the temple. That's what's left of the retaining wall that's there. There's nothing left of the temple. But it's considered to be, holy ground, just like if because it was part of the building project there to make the temple. Now, the peak of Mount Moriah, if you are allowed to and you're not, to go into the Dome of the Rock, which is the big golden dome on top there, that's a mosque. The actual stone peak of Moriah is inside the Dome of the Rock. That's why it's called that, the Dome of the Rock. Okay, so that's kind of the peak. So where the Dome of the Rock is now is where the temple was before it was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. So you'll notice, those of you who are going, we will get to the Wailing Wall. We'll have some time for prayer there. Just so you know, you're separated by men and women at the Wailing Wall. There's a little fence, a cyclone fence, and so they'll separate us. And you can pray there at the Wailing Wall, and you are allowed to make little prayer notes and stick them in the crevices. So just be ready. You may want to do that ahead of time or something if you want to, or just have something to write with, whatever comes to mind at that point. Okay, so this is 950 or so BC when Solomon builds the first temple, right? So that temple doesn't last, right? It's destroyed by the Babylonians. So in 587, the Babylonians conquer Judah, which is the southern part of the nation of Israel. By now, it's two separate kingdoms, Israel and Judah. Israel had already been conquered by the Assyrians, and that the capital of Israel was in Samaria. And then Judah is where Jerusalem is. Everybody clear on that? So Judah, the southern kingdom, remained for another 150 or so years before Babylon came and took them away. So when Jeremiah has been warning them about that, if you don't straighten up, if you don't quit worshiping idols, it's not going to be good for you. And it wasn't. They take them off in exile, and the temple is destroyed. Solomon's temple, right? So, and there's this amazing, when you have time, I can't tell you the chapter, but it's early in Ezekiel. Ezekiel is the most fun prophet to read because he loves mushrooms, I'm sure. Because he talks crazy stuff all the time. But he has this incredible description of what happens when the temple is destroyed, that the Spirit of God rises up out of the temple and hovers over it and is blown away. It's kind of like a Lord of the Rings kind of thing, right? Because God's house was no longer standing, right? So it's really pretty amazing. All right, so about 50 years of exile, and then Cyrus, who's the king in Persia, conquers the Babylonians, and he allows the Jews to return to Jerusalem, and they set about the task of rebuilding the temple, right? So Ezra and Nehemiah are the guys who are involved in that. There's a whole bunch of Old Testament stuff. You can read about that if you want to. Okay? So I'm trying to get you up to Jesus' time. Around 330 BC, so a couple hundred years later, this is when Alexander the Great was ruling this whole area. He has conquered that land. He's replaced the Persians. And then when he dies, his empire is divided up among his generals. And Ptolemy, who was in Egypt, has the Holy Land with him. And then eventually he is defeated by Antiochus in Syria, who was another general of Alexander's. So he's Antiochus the First, Antiochus the Fourth is someone you've heard about. So he's a Syrian, and he called himself Epiphanes. So you may have heard that from Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, which means a manifestation of God, right? So if I'm going to be a conquering emperor, I will call myself a manifestation of God, because you can, right? Why not? So it is he who is the one who put a statue of himself in the temple, right? The rebuilt temple. And that was called the Abomination of Desolation. Daniel had prophesied about that, right? And so he put it in the actual Holy of Holies. So you couldn't have desecrated the place any more than what he did. And that is why the Maccabeans rose up against Antiochus IV. It was a revolt. If you've ever read 1st and 2nd Maccabees, it's an amazing story. It's historical. It's where the Hanukkah tradition comes from, you know, how the candles wouldn't go out and all that kind of stuff, right? And so they were successful, the Maccabees, lead a revolt, and they're successful to cleanse the temple. The menorah's relit, all this kind of stuff takes place. This is around 165 B.C. It's short-lived. The Maccabees are also, their family is called the Hasmoneans, and they are ruling Israel. But then there's a civil war amongst them, and this allows Rome to come in and just kind of take over. And this is around 65 B.C., before Jesus is born. So within the memories of people who were alive when Jesus was born, this is taking place. Rome now rules the area and takes over everything. And so the Jewish state is under other people's rule from then on until 1948. When Israel was reestablished as a nation. So from 68 B.C. until 1948, they did not have an autonomous state. That's a long time. Okay, around 40 B.C., Herod the Great is appointed king by the Romans. He is Herod the Great for several reasons, mainly because he was a great builder. He was an amazing builder, and you'll see a lot of evidence of that when we go over there. He was a mixed breed. He was part Jewish, part Edomian, which is one reason why the Jewish people never really cared for him. And he was not appointed by them. He was appointed by Rome, right, to rule over them. He married a Hasmonean, trying to kind of solidify himself as one of the good guys. But he also was insane, literally. And he, make sure I'm recording. He got nervous about what would happen to sons that she bore him. Would the people support them more because they're Hasmonean? He's not. So he murdered her and all of the sons that she gave him. Yeah, he's a good guy. So that's what he's known for. He's very cruel, vicious person without, you know, just any moral standing at all. But he also was an incredible builder. And you'll see Masada, the rebuilding of the temple. He has palaces all over the place. We'll see some of that stuff when we're over there. Okay, so after he kills her, he builds a memorial tower to her in Jerusalem, because he was that kind of a good guy, right? So it is around, I think I've told you this, 4 B.C. that Jesus is born, right? So as I told you before, when we initially numbered the years on the calendar, they messed up, right? So 4 B.C. instead of 0 A.D. is when Jesus is born, and that's when Herod learns from the wise men, and wants all the babies killed, and Jesus escapes from that. There's also some legend around John the Baptist, how he escapes from that. We might touch on that today. Okay? So, Jesus, now during this time, Herod is rebuilding the temple itself, or adding on to, and it had already been rebuilt, but he increases the size of the temple tremendously, and adds a lot of ornate stuff to it. So that was one of his building projects, was I think he about doubled the size of the temple itself. Did a lot of work on the temple, wanted it called Herod's Temple instead of Solomon's Temple, you know, this kind of stuff. And so what you're seeing on your map is a representation of the size of the temple during Herod's time on the map that I gave you. Now, we'll get into some of this in more detail, but I'm trying to see on your map where you see on the left. On this side over here, probably not even on this one, it says Golgotha. traditional location. So you see, it's not real far from the temple area, but it would have been, you see the little orange wall on the right of Golgotha? All right, so that's the original wall. We've excavated and know that it was there when the walls of Jerusalem were built or rebuilt after exile. That's where the wall was. So we know that Jesus was crucified outside of town, outside the walls. And also, the Romans, their habit was to crucify, execute criminals in a very public way. This would have been an intersection of some major roads because they wanted people to see this is what happens to you if you disobey, right? So that wall, that orange wall, was there. And then later, you see second north wall, Josephus' second north wall going across. It's black above Golgotha,
yeah.
Right? So that wall was built a short time after Jesus' crucifixion. And then above that second wall, before the third wall, where it says Bethesda, you see Gordon's Calvary in the Garden Tomb. That's the alternative location for the crucifixion and the tomb. And we'll be going there as well. And I'll talk about that in more detail today, I hope. All right, is everybody kind of straight on that? I don't go into too much more on all the stuff with Jerusalem itself, because we want to get to where we're going. Okay. So, you also have to keep in mind, and I'll cover some of this kind of quickly today. We're going to go fast, and we'll be here as long as y'all are able to stay. So if you go over time, hang with me. But keep in mind that the Holy Land becomes a real political football, or has always been, obviously, right? And even more so in more recent times. So you had the situation where, you know, the Romans destroyed the temple. Eventually the Roman Empire goes away, and the Muslim Empire comes to prominence. So 6th century is Muhammad, and they consider Jerusalem to be a holy city. In fact, it was right up there in Mecca for a long time and still is considered a holy site for them. Mount Moriah, in the Muslim understanding, it was Ishmael that Abraham took up on the mountain of sacrifice, but it was that same mountain, Mount Moriah, etc. So they're intertwining the story as well. And so we end up with all these battles going back and forth between who is controlling the Holy Land. And that includes the Crusades. So the Crusaders are stirred up and sent over. There's four different Crusades over a couple hundred years that come over, and they recapture Jerusalem. They rebuild churches or build churches over sites. Then they get thrown out. Then they come back. Then they get thrown out. Then they come back. So that's going on and on. It's not good for anybody. And it's certainly not good for the holy sites. So the walls of Jerusalem as they exist now that you will see date from the 16th century. So the newer walls are from the 16th century. So you'll see, we'll go through some of those. But we also will see some of the foundations of the older walls. You've heard off and on, I'm sure, about all these different gates that are in the walls. The gates are some of the gates are really close together. Some are really far apart. They're usually named after either something that's right inside the gate or going out of the gate would take you to a certain place. Like the Damascus Gate is how you get on the road to Syria. Right, et cetera. So the gates have these different names. Some a beautiful gate, et cetera, et cetera. We'll see those. I don't really get into too much about that, because we could talk about that forever. Although the one we probably should pay attention to is the lovely name Dung Gate. Is what we will go through on the way to the Western Wall, to the Wailing Wall, and to the Dome of the Rock. By the way, the Dome of the Rock, and I'm going to ramble a lot today, so you just got to catch up if you can. The Dome of the Rock is a mosque. It's an active mosque. It's a beautiful landscaped area up there. From the Wailing Wall, you ascend up to go through a gate to the Dome of the Rock. You go through Muslim security to get there. I think I've told you that. You can't take any Christian or Jewish artifacts with you. You can't take a Bible with you, or at least not have one showing. You can put your crosses in your shirt, etc., because it's their holy ground. And you cannot dare hold any kind of a prayer service up there, anything like that. They will run you out at gunpoint. So you can pray to yourself, right, basically. And if our timing is bad, if it's during one of their calls to prayer, we can't go up there at all. So they try to, the guys try to time things around that. So you at least can go up there and see the fountains and all kind of stuff up there. And you can't go inside the Dome of Rock itself, but you can go around it. So that'll be part of what we do. Okay, Let's look at our first stop, I think, on our tour is the Pool of Bethesda, or Bethsaida, how you want to pronounce it. So if you turn to John chapter 5, anybody bring a Bible? You know the story, probably. What is interesting about this pool, I didn't get to see this my first time, so I'm excited to be going there. It's how it's described in this passage is what we have found it to be just like. All right, so if we read chapter 5, let's read 2 through, it's a lot. Why don't y'all just follow along with me? I'm going to scan through it because we're kind of short on time today. All right, so this is Jesus had gone to Jerusalem for a festival, and he enters through the sheep gate, and there's a pool called Hebrew Bethesda. Bethesda is another name for it, which means healing. And it had 5 porticos, and we have unearthed the 5 porticos, so we know exactly where this pool is. And there were many invalids who lay by the pool, right? And so there's a man who had been ill there for 38 years, and Jesus said, how come... what's the deal, dude? Why aren't you getting well? And the question Jesus asked in verse 6 is, do you want to be made well? That Greek word well can be better translated whole. I love the King James translation in this one, actually. It says, do thou want to be made whole? Right? So it's much more than just about his physical healing. It's being made whole. And the man says, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. That was the belief that an angel came down and touched the water. And for a very short period of time, whoever got to the water first would be healed. And he couldn't make it. So for 38 years, he's been laying there by that pool trying to get in there before everybody else does. And it's never happened for him. Someone else always steps ahead of me. Jesus says, stand up and take your mat and walk. So we will stop at that place as one of our entries, one of our first things we do in Jerusalem. And then he gets into the typical argument, theological argument with the Pharisees about healing on the Sabbath because it is a Sabbath day, and Jesus is explaining to them why he can do that because the Son can do it. God continued to do stuff on the Sabbath, and so the Son can do that as well. That, of course, is blasphemy to them, so he's kind of setting up as he goes along, you know, making sure they're going to take care of him later. So, all right, so that's Bethsaida. Our next stop is, well, Chapel of Flagellation, and to the bazaar, to the last station of the cross, Via Dolorosa, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the Golgotha Pavement. So I'm going to kind of cover a lot of that here. There's a lot of little churches, chapels that we won't spend a lot of time on, but there's a Church of St. Anne that's in this general area. Anne is believed to be the mother of Mary, right? And some legends are that Mary was actually born there on the site of where the Church of St. Anne is. She grew up in Nazareth. But she was born there, and Anne is her mother. So there's a church there. It has a bunch of Mary stuff. I think the Crusaders built that church when they came through, like in 1200 or so. And then the Via Dolorosa, the Way of the Cross. I don't think we'll walk all the stations of the Via Dolorosa because there is a time crunch to do that. But I hope you have a good experience. I know Ellen Shepherd says it was the most powerful part of her time, the first time she went, was thinking about, I'm walking those steps as Jesus was headed towards Calvary, carrying his own cross, falling down, you know, Simon of Cyrene coming, picking up the cross and helping him and all that kind of stuff. You know the story. This is where our Station of the Cross kind of comes from, ours that we stole from the Catholics. And so we'll walk some of the stations. The stations are labeled so you know where you are. If y'all want, we can bring the Station of the Cross booklets, but we're not going to have time to stop and say the prayers that are in each of the stations. But maybe if you have something with you so you knew which station was what, so when you come back and do the Station of the Cross, oh, I would remember when I was there. The negative to the Station of the Cross is twofold. One is super crowded, and number two is the merchants and vendors along the way are ridiculous, and they really kind of get in your head. A little bit, at least they did for me. Ellen didn't have the experience, so it might just be me. And it also depends on what day of the week you're there. Friday, they have an actual procession that goes through every station. led by Christian pastors or whatever. So it might be better when you're, if you're part of that versus just your group. I don't know. I don't know what day of the week we're going to be there. I can't keep up with that stuff. It's going, this leads to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is where the original Golgotha, the one on the southern one, not the Garden Tomb one. Now, some of the old city is really, really old with paved streets and walls. There's this thing that we'll see at some point called the Cardo, which was what the Romans did when Jerusalem was rebuilt. And it's kind of, it's like a mall, but it runs, there's two parts of it. There's the north-south part and the east-west part, but it's where all the merchants from way, way, way back when had set up their stalls to sell their goods and food and et cetera. And you can see all the, what, how the Romans made this thing. It's pretty cool, actually, to see some of that stuff. That's part of what you'll see in Jerusalem. You will also see, if we're going, I don't know if we're going to the first station or not, but at the very first station, you'll see often a lot of weapons from the Israeli army, because even Israeli soldiers will come and tour Jerusalem, and they're not allowed to go up on the Western Wall with weapons any more than anybody else can, other than the guards that are there already. It's kind of weird to walk up and see all these guns being guarded there. If you look at the on the map, you see Antonia Fortress above the temple. Herod had built that there to keep soldiers ready for any incidents that happened in the temple. And then when Rome was reinforcing their troops, etc., in Jerusalem, they used it to have to garrison their soldiers there. If you remember the story of Paul when he makes it back to Jerusalem and they stir up the crowd against him, they want to kill him. The centurion goes and gets the soldiers from this fortress to come and save Paul and take him back there to protect him. So we pass by that, by the first gate on the way to the Western Wall. Okay, so other areas around there have to do with Herod's fortress you see on the left, Herod's palace, the Praetorium, the Tower of Marianne, the Tower of Hippocrates, etc. Some of these are places possibly that the story of Jesus when he's arrested and he's taken to trial, Peter denies him, he's taken to another place where he's flogged, he's taken to another place where he meets Pilate. Those are what those places on the left-hand side where it says Upper City are. We will see some of those along the way. I can't remember exactly which one. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Sepulchre means tomb. So the history of this place is when, I don't have pictures of it, so look it up, use your imagination until you get there, those that are going. So it's not, when you approach it, you're like, well, this is no big deal. It's just kind of a bunch of buildings around it and this kind of stuff, and it's kind of plain entry to it. It's multiple levels. There's like six different Christian churches that run parts of it, including some monks who live on the roof in these little huts. And you can go up there and see the little huts. And they are very aesthetic. I mean, they just have nothing. And that's what they base their cells, but they really look like little igloos made out of bricks up there. And this little group of monks, I forget where they're from. But the history of the Church of Holy Sepulchre is that when Constantine became emperor in 320 or so, maybe a little earlier than that, of Rome, he made Christianity the official religion. So that's when the persecution of the Christians stopped and Christianity really exploded after that point. His mother, St. Helena, had a big connection with the Holy Land, and so she had gone there, and the legend is that she found pieces of the original cross, and within the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you'll see the place where that supposedly took place. And she talked to the people there about where's the tomb, where's Calvary, etc. And they all said, as far back as we can remember, and this is 300, so not that long after Jesus, but as far back as Grandpa and Great-Grandpa told us, Christians that come to these spots to recognize that this is a place of Jesus' crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. So she said, well, obviously, what do we have to do? Got to build a church, right? So she has a church built over that site. So what is shocking to you is trying to imagine this the way you've always imagined it, because Calvary is inside a building, as is the tomb, right? And, you know, we have this image of outside the walls of the town, you know, a cross, and then a tomb and a rock wall and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's where it all took place. Most scholars believe this is the place, but it's not going to look anything like that at all to you, at all. So you've got to use your imagination a lot. So she built the church over it. That church was destroyed, and all this fighting back and forth. The Crusaders came when they conquered Jerusalem, and they built this big basilica over all of it. And that's pretty much what's there now. They enhanced it since then, but it's this huge open room where inside it is the edicule, which you've probably seen on TV, the little bitty chapel-looking thing where the tomb is. So it's inside this rotunda, giant rotunda there. So the Crusaders built that. It's been, you know, whacked around a little bit and rebuilt and that kind of stuff and enhanced. Let me get back to the tomb in a minute. When you approach the door into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, you will see up on the second floor landing a ladder. That ladder has been there since the mid-19th century when the status quo was established. The Ottoman Empire was in control of Jerusalem, and fortunately they had a series of leaders in the Ottoman Empire who protected the Christian holy sites. Right, and so, but there's all these different churches fighting over who was in charge of what, who could have services when, that kind of stuff. He just finally had it. And he said, we are freezing everything exactly like it is. That ladder had been put outside of a window. Either the legend is, either there's some monks who were trying to escape, and so they were using that ladder, or there was a time where other Christians were holding the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in siege and not allowing food to come in, and so they would sneak out on that ladder and people would throw food up to them. Right? So the ladder was sitting there when he established the status quo, which meant nothing can be changed. So the ladder can't be moved. So it's been sitting there ever since the mid-1800s. Right? So, except once some Protestants played a trick and stole it one time, but they found it and put it back. So it's just kind of an example of how difficult it is to get the Orthodox and the Armenians and the Catholics and the other folks to get along. Franciscans, all these different groups. I think they're Coptic Christians that have a piece of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They all want some of it, right? It's the holiest place on earth to Christians. So they could not get along. So what he did was he established the status quo, gave the keys to the door to a Muslim family who don't have a dog in that hunt. So they still have them, and they unlock the church doors every day and lock them back at the end of the day. So it's not, none of these warring Christian groups have control over who can get in, who can't. And that's still the case today. The family still has the key to the church. All right, so when you enter into the church of the Holy Sepulchre, you can take a right hand. Well, when you first come in, there's this big rock there in the middle of it that and is facing a mural. The mural is the cross, Jesus being taken off the cross, Jesus being anointed in preparation for burial. So that's what the mural is. And then this rock sits there, and legend is that's the rock Jesus was laid on after he was crucified before he's taken to the tomb. So it's considered a very holy spot, and you will see people kneeling and praying at that rock, putting things like their rosary beads or the cross on there for a blessing and that kind of stuff. If you want to do that, you're more than welcome to do it. You might have to fight your way to it because there's a lot of people there. So there's that right there. Then you go upstairs to go to Calvary. And there's like three different chapels up there, and each one of them, the guy will explain to you what they are. But one is the chapel where supposedly the cross or remnant of the cross was found. Another is the Chapel of Calvary itself. And so there's a Catholic chapel and an Orthodox chapel, and they all have different claims as part of the story. They don't claim that, well, I'm the real spot and I'm the real spot. It's all part of the story, but they're under different Christian denominations are taking care of each one of those. So you can go up there, you can pray. They're beautiful. They're ornate. They have a lot of candles and silver and gold and all that kind of stuff all over the place up there. But it's hard to think of it. Again, maybe just me because I don't have imagination like I wish I did. To think, oh, this is on a hill outside of town, right? It's inside this building, you know, stuff. But anyway, you'll have time to look at all that and pray about it. Spend some time there. I recommend you do that. And then you come down and go into the actual rotunda, and that's where the edicule. Edicule just means small building. And you might have heard last year that they did some renovation on the tomb. You know, keep up with that. Yeah, it's really cool. And they brought in a bunch of scientists from different backgrounds and using a lot of updated, you know, x-rays and that kind of stuff. And when you see the edicule, you understand why. The amount of candles around this place is unbelievable. They're all hanging down from these chains, that kind of stuff. So there's been a lot of smoke damage inside the edicule. You go inside the edicule, you can go in and you can peer through. They cut a little window where you can look in and see a shelf that the tombs of that time had shelves that the bodies would lay on. But you've got about a tenth of a second to do that. And when I went, we didn't get to do it at all because the line was 3 hours long just to get in there. And just going in and out, in and out, in and out. And you also, the lines, just like at Church of Holy Nativity, are stopped when they're going to have a service, because they have services all day long in the edicule. The Easter Vigil would be something to see at this place, because what the Orthodox do is the patriarch of the Orthodox Church goes into the edicule during the Easter Vigil before sunrise on Easter Day, and he has an unlit candle, and the Holy Spirit lights the candle, and he comes out with it, and they light all the other candles from it. So that's the past. You know, we light a new fire when we do the Easter Vigil, right? That's where that comes from, is from that practice. And so they still do that as part of the Easter Vigil, although they say God is lighting the candle, not, they don't use a bick. So, who knows? It's only him in there. So, yeah.
Sure.
Not sure, actually. So you'll see a lot of Orthodox priests and other folks around there doing stuff during time. Some people bring candles and light it from the candles that are there. They will let you do that if you want to. You know, have to blow it out, of course, but at least you have a candle that was lit from the candles at the edicule, stuff like that. So, again, it's in this giant rotunda area, and there's 18 billion people gathered around trying to do this stuff. All right, so other parts in the Church Holy Sepulchre, and I can't tell you what our guides are going to take us to see, but there's a Chapel of Adam in there, and you can look at it. It's underneath where Calvary is, and they have a glass window where you can see it. The legend is that Adam was buried there at the base of Calvary. That came out of medieval times. I don't know how they DNA tested it, but that's what they claim. There's a Roman Catholic sanctuary with a choir loft that has this frieze that was really gorgeous to see. And opposite is an altar of Mary Magdalene. And on it, this is really cool. You remember the story of Mary Magdalene in chapter, I'm sorry, I just don't want to take a lot of time to go into the scripture. But you remember the version of the resurrection where it's just her, right? And that's in John's gospel. And she thinks Jesus is a gardener, right? Says, if you know where they've taken my Lord, can you tell me? And then he calls her name, and she says, Rabuni, and she knows who he is. The little chapel of Mary Magdalene has hanging on that a picture of Jesus dressed like a gardener with a hoe in his hand. So this is why she didn't know who he was. She thought he was a gardener. It's pretty cool, actually. There's a chapel of Blessed Sacrament dedicated to Jesus and his appearing to his mother. That's one of the mysteries of the Franciscan Rosary. It's not in the scripture, but it's something the Franciscans have taken and prayed forever and ever. There's an Armenian chapel that has thousands of crosses that have been placed there by pilgrims over the centuries, and a beautiful mosaic floor with all the great churches of Armenia, which is the first nation converted to Christianity before the Roman Empire was. And then you just got all these different little spots we can go to. There is a statue of St. Helena there as well, Constantine's mother, who kind of got all this going for all of us. All right. Let's see, what's next on here? We will see the bazaar, which is in the old city, and you can buy stuff there. If you want, I bought chickpeas. chickpeas. Yeah, that does. Now we made hummus out of them. And then we're going to go to Iyan Karim, which is the birthplace of John the Baptist. I think I've talked about that a little bit already. So this is just a tiny little village, and in the village itself is the Church of John the Baptist. You can go in there and take pictures. It's a very small church, very, very pretty. And then you have to go up on the hill to the Church of the Visitation, which is a monastery now. And that's where Mary visited Elizabeth, right? And both of them had their babies, and her baby left in the womb because Jesus was there, et cetera. And you've got, that's the place where all the different countries have sent Madonnas and the Magnificat in all their own languages. And there's a beautiful chapel in there, et cetera. It's well worth the walk, but it is a steep climb to that. So we get to see those two spots. Now, the reason that chapel is separate from the village is how priests had to prepare themselves. John the Baptist's father was a priest, remember? And so they were on a rota, and they only got to serve in the temple like 1 week a year, because there's so many priests. And so you had to prepare yourself as a priest before your time came, and you had to remove yourself from your family. You couldn't have sexual relations with your spouse. You had to eat the right kind of food and purify yourself before your week. So the legend, and it probably is true, is that John's dad had a little house up there that he would go to prepare himself before it's his time to go to Jerusalem. It's very close to Jerusalem. And serve his week on the priestly rota up there. So they built that chapel on that spot of his second home, or whatever you want to call it. So that's pretty cool. All right. Boy, we're going fast. Let's see where else. The Cardo I've already talked about. Mount Moriah, Dome of the Rock, Western Wall, et cetera, et cetera. Wow, that's all day six. Now, I'll take a breath and see what's missing in my description of everything. What do you want to ask me about? We got more Jerusalem to do on day 8 and 9. By the way, those of you who are going, day 8 is an off day, so you can sleep late, go shopping, watch TV, whatever you want to do. One thing the tour group has not included in our tour is the Holocaust Museum. So it is well worth it. So I'm planning on going on that day 8. I'll try and get some details. I think you can just take a cab there, and the entry fee is not very much. It's amazing, and it's an incredible, incredible place, especially when you go into the children's wing and stuff like that. So if you want to do that, I highly recommend it to you, but it is very emotional. Very emotional. But that's something you can do. Other than that, there's also little day tours you can do around town if you want to do something organized. We can look at all that when we get over there. So that'll be up to y'all, if you want to do that or not. All right. So I'm going to skip to the garden tomb. Yes. Yes, right. Yep.
Where is that?
I don't know where that is. I have not done that before. I think they were doing a lot of archaeological digs around what has been commonly called the City of David. Some of that was closed off when I was there before. There's a tunnel that Hezekiah had built to escape. I think I might be part of what they've unearthed there. So I'm guessing that's what it is. So I'm not 100% sure. We do go to the, upper room at some point? That's all. Yeah, we did. Okay.
We'll just walk. This is all walking.
Yes, this is all walking. Right. John the Baptist village will drive to and come back. But yeah, all this stuff in Jerusalem is not a lot of walking, actually. When I did it, we started at the Tomb of David and walked all the way through the city, down the Cardo, around to the Western Wall, and up. And there was a bar mitzvah going on. You imagine having your bar mitzvah at the Western Wall? So we encounter the bar mitzvah party early in our walking, and there's this kid being carried on everybody's shoulders, and all these folks, and they have balloons and banners and that kind of stuff. And then we run into it again, and they're singing all these songs in Hebrew and stuff. And then we got to the Western Wall, there they were again. It was really neat. I said, man, what do I do your bar mitzvah? Okay, I do want to talk about the garden tomb. So, if I can find it in here. Y'all see it on your map? Okay, so that's on our last day, and we will have communion there. All right, so the garden tomb, or Gordon's Calvary. Gordon is the name. All right, so at the end of World War I, the Ottomans were defeated in the Holy Land by the Allies, and Great Britain was given control of the Holy Land, right, if you remember your history. And so the area of the garden tomb is the last part of Jerusalem or anywhere in the Holy Land that Great Britain still controls. So they still own this little piece. So when you get there, you have Great Britain, you have English guides taking you around. And Gordon was the name of the leader of the army, the Great Britain soldiers that were there maintaining this space. And he is given credit for discovering what he believed to be the real site of Calvary and the tomb. So Calvary itself, Calvarius in Latin, I think it's Latin, means skull, right? So it's the place of the skull, right? Golgotha, maybe it's Golgotha, I mean, anyway, that's Calvary. Calvary does in Latin. That's why it's called Golgotha, which is Greek for the place of the skull, and Calvary, which is Latin for it. So, you know, the description we have in the Gospels is that it looks like a skull, right? The place looks like a skull. Well, when you go to Gordon's Calvary, there's a little sightseeing area. It's really kind of funny because you're at this place that might be the actual holy spot, and you're looking over here at it, and over here is a city bus terminal moving people in and out all day long. But you look, there's limestone cliffs that you can look, and it looks exactly like a skull. And they have pictures of it from way back in the 19th century to now, how it's always looked like that. You can see the eyes, you can see a mouth. I mean, it looks like a place you would call the place of a skull. And then you go to the garden tomb. So we know from the scriptures that the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea was in a garden, right? And it was a fresh tomb. Well, this garden has existed since before Jesus' time. And it has, it's a very plush garden, still a garden. It has a well and a cistern to hold water to irrigate there, and that's dated way back to before Jesus' time as well. So we know it was a garden. And he's got the skull, and there are tombs. Now, what the way smarter than me people will tell you is the kind of tomb that's there did not exist at Jesus' time. It came maybe a century or two later. They changed how they did their tombs. So that's why most scholars think the original spot is the place where Church Holy Sepulchre is the spot versus this one, which was kind of late to the game. But I'm telling you, they tell a very convincing story when you're there. And it's a very quiet, there are different tour groups going around, but everybody's just kind of respectful, and it's not this hustle and bustle, and it's outdoors, you know, instead of trying to figure out across inside of a building, you know. And you see a tomb. They don't claim that this tomb is Jesus' tomb, but you can see the tomb, how the tomb was made. You can go into it, and there is a trough in front of it for rolling a stone in front of the tomb. And so what the archaeologists tell us is it was later than Jesus' time before they started, got smart enough to put those troughs in there to roll stones in front of it. So before then, they just didn't have that, but you'll see it. And when you go into the tomb, what they would do is the tombs often were family tombs, right? There could be more than one body in there. So they anoint the body, it's used on embalm, right? So they anoint the body, and that's part of Jesus' story, right? They wanted to anoint his body, the Sabbath was coming, so they wait till Sunday to go anoint him because they couldn't do it on the Sabbath, and that's when, well, he's not there, the tomb is empty, etc. So they would anoint the bodies, they would wrap them in linen, the head would have a different linen cloth, and they would lay it on either in kind of a trough inside there for the older tombs or on a little platform. So when you go in there, what I recall is you can kind of look when you go, you duck into the tomb, you look over here, there's a couple of these little, like, benches, kind of, that bodies would have been laid on. Right? And they would have a period of mourning of, like, 30 days, where family members would go and visit the tomb and pray and, you know, just like we do, right? But eventually, the tomb is sealed off long enough for the body to completely decompose. Because the body's going to stay there. They take the bones and put them in a box called an ossuary. And they will put some kind of inscription on the box, and then that gets buried in a cemetery. So the tomb is more of a funeral home visitation spot for X amount of time until the body is ready to be, the bones themselves are ready to be interred somewhere. So you can go in and see this tomb, and really, I think, can imagine what would have been like for Peter and John to duck their head, and that's what the gospel says. They lowered their heads and went into the tomb, and there's these two people in white, or one's been on the gospel, right? Angel saying, "Why? What are you looking for here? He's not here. He's risen." Just like he told you, right? That kind of stuff. And it's really a much better way to kind of imagine and picture that I'm in that spot or not. So garden tomb, I think, is the very last thing we do on the trip. And they say that we'll have communion there on that spot as well, which makes sense. Okay? Any questions about that? I had never heard of the garden tomb before I went on this trip the first time. And it really was a fabulous place to visit and see and think about. All right, so let's get to the Mount of Olives. You okay if we keep going?
Yeah.
All right. Where are you? We're not going to go to Emmaus. We'll go to Qumran. Okay. So if you look on your map, on the eastern side you see Mount of Olives and the Kidron Valley. Right on the right hand side there. Y'all see that? Okay. So the Mount of Olives is prominent in the gospel stories, right? On the other side of the Mount of Olives from Jerusalem, the opposite side is Bethany. And Bethany is where Mary and Martha live, and Lazarus. But we see Bethany mentioned quite a bit in the gospel stories, and that lends us to believe that Jesus was really good friends with them, right? I mean, that's all the whole story about Lazarus, is how upset they are and how upset he is, etc. But it may have been a place they could come when they're doing Jerusalem stuff. You would see Jesus come into the town, teach in the temple, get into these debates with the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and then he would go back to Bethany to spend the night. Right? And then so you come over this hill, Mount of Olives, and on the other side of Mount of Olives from Bethany, there's Jerusalem laid out for you. And you get a great view of Jerusalem from up there. That's where the Garden of Gethsemane is, right? It's where Jesus went to pray. So obviously it's not real far from, you know, the upper room is in Jerusalem. The Garden of Gethsemane is in the Mount of Olives. So they would just gone up on that hill to pray, and that's where he was arrested. You know, Peter chops off the ear of the guard and all that kind of slave and all that kind of stuff takes place. There are quite a few churches up on the Mount of Olives from different denominations. There is actually a Mosque of the Ascension. So Muslims don't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but they do believe Jesus was a prophet. And they have a lot of respect for Jesus, although they don't believe in the resurrection stuff. They do believe he ascended to heaven. And so they built a mosque in the Mount of Olives to commemorate that. It's in Acts chapter 1 when Jesus ascends. It's in the Mount of Olives when that takes place, right? So you can see between the Mount of Olives and the actual wall of Jerusalem is a cemetery. That's a Jewish cemetery. Not real sure how long that's been there, but a good while. You can see the Dome of the Rock and stuff very, very clearly kind of laid out for you there. You can imagine the Palm Sunday procession starting from the Mount of Olives, right, coming down through the gate into the city, so you can see where all that took place. And then there are there's ancient olive groves there that do date back to pre-Jesus time. It's hard to kill an olive tree, I've been told. The branches might have been regenerated or whatever, but the roots, they have tested these roots and they are over 2,000 years old. yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. And I think I told you one of the vendors ran up to me with a little leaf from an olive tree telling me this is from Jesus' tree. I was like, how do you know that? well, for a dollar, you can have it too. So, we will, I'm sure, well, I shouldn't say I'm sure of anything. Garden, Church of All Nations. We will go to Church of All Nations. Very cool spot in the Garden of Gethsemane. There's a lot of liturgies that take place in there. There'll be a lot of people, but there's also is kind of inside the altar area is a slab that purported to be where Jesus knelt when he was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he had tears of blood, sweat of blood. You remember that from the Gospels? So that's right there. So I had a very holy moment at that spot. And it's one of the first things we did when we got there. So it's a good place to sit and pray for a time. Okay, the Kidron Valley is just the valley between the Mount of Olives and Jerusalem itself. That's just the name of a stream that goes through there. I think you see that on your map. The Hinnon Valley and the Kidron. You see the Hinnon Valley on the bottom? Hinnon means Hinnon Stream. That became the name of the place that Jesus described as hell, Gehenna, right? And that was, it was a garbage dump. And so it burned all the time. So describing hell like that would have made sense to people hearing him talk about it, right? So that was outside the walls is where they did all their trash. You see City of David and Lower City. That's where a lot of excavations are still ongoing. But there is a place there where it said David is buried. That's unconfirmed. Near that is the upper room, which is on what they call Mount Zion. So it's part of Jerusalem, but it's just kind of a raised part in that southern quadrant down there. Southeastern quadrant. You see upper city, Zion, Herod's palaces, and et cetera. The scene quarter, that's the scenes that ended up in Qumran. They had their own little area of Jerusalem that they lived in. And you can see a little thing that says upper room, traditional location. Can you see that in the scene quarter? All right, so the upper room, the place of the Last Supper, right? The Gospels tell us that Jesus sends Peter and John out. You'll find somebody, and you say, can we use your room? And they say yes, and they go up there, and they have the Passover meal together. And that's from there that Judas goes out to betray Jesus. Very controversial about whether this is really the site of that or not, but you can go up and look at it. It's been both a synagogue and a mosque over time, but they preserve some of the structure of the synagogue itself. But it is just a kind of a big over room, and this, you know, again, it's hard to tell if that's really the spot or not. But we will get to see that. Tomb of King David is where I had a very strange encounter with. I was walking by it. And this little sign on the door, I think it that area is actually owned by the Israeli government as a tourist park. And so my group was walking by, and this guy comes out and says, hey, let me show you something. And I was stupid enough to follow him. Jennifer, nobody even knew I was doing it, so I could be dead. But he takes me into this room, and there's a well bucket inside this well. So this is King David's well. And he lowers it down and gets some water out of it and brings it back up and has me taste some of the water. So I survived that. I don't recommend it. I have no idea what I was drinking. But, I mean, he was very, very nice and very cool to let me do that. But then he wanted some money, you know, donation for doing that for me. So I, you know, gave him some shekels or something like that. So I was set up. But it was kind of cool. I was in there by myself. I came out and Jim was like, everybody's freaking out because we can't find you. So this guy threw me down as well. But, okay, so we'll get to see those things. We'll drive from Mount of Olives. We'll pass the tombs of Absalom, Zechariah, and James, and then we go to the Last Supper in King David's tomb. And then the way we're doing this, we'll end at the Garden tomb. That'll wrap it up. So day 7, I skipped over. Let's just do that real quick. Masada again. We have to drive down to the Dead Sea. We'll go to Qumran. Which is fascinating place. They have done an amazing job with the archaeology there. That's where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. You'll hear that story. You'll see the caves. You'll see what they've excavated as far as how the people lived and the ritual baths and all that kind of stuff that they did. right on the shore of the Dead Sea. And then Masada is this fortress that Herod built. And when Rome was destroying Jerusalem, the last stand of the Jewish army was at Masada. Y'all want to wait and hear the story when you get there? You can, why don't we just do that? They tell it better than I do, but it's a story I was not familiar with before I went. It was pretty cool. Now, it doesn't mention it, and hopefully it won't happen, but my tour stopped at a Dead Sea gift shop where you too could buy Dead Sea salt and mud for your complexion and stuff. So that was, I wrote a very non-nice review about that part of it because it was ridiculous. But anyway, we do pass the spot where, if you remember, when Saul was trying to kill David, David hides out with his men in some caves. We'll pass that spot. Saul even goes in because he has to poop. This is in the Bible, and I'm going to get up. And David has a chance to kill him while he's doing that. And David says, I'm not going to kill a man while he's doing that. That's not fair. Right? Old Testament has some great stories, right? So, and I agree with David about that. It really wouldn't be fair. Anyway, we'll pass that spot. I don't think the poop is still there, but the cave is. Yeah. Missing an opportunity, right? Okay. All right, I think that's it. What questions, concerns, comments? All right, everybody's got all your travel docs that are going. I'm making name tags for you that I'll have. I'm also going to have little booklets with morning prayer and compline in them, so we can do that every day, those who are so inclined. Hope everybody has arranged how to get into Miami by now. And got all that worked out. Any travel questions? My usual answer to travel questions is, I don't know. Call them, they'll tell you. But,
what's the hotel? Hampton Inn.
At the airport?
You can park your car at or something?
Yeah, several people are doing that, I think. Jennifer and I are actually going on Thanksgiving Day and visit some friends down in South Florida for a few days.
Yeah.
So we'll be there ahead of time. Thank you. We leave Monday the 26th, like at 1:30 p.m. We have to be at the airport 3 hours ahead. Y'all got all that in your docs, I think. Don't forget your passport, please. You won't be going if you do. Yes?
I have a question about your prescription medicines. They have to be in their original bottle.
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
I've never heard of anybody ever being questioned about their prescriptions, so it's not a big deal.
7 days,
12 hours. That's what I would recommend. I'm sure that's what I did last time. That's not a bad idea. Some people get a note from their doctor saying this person's taking all this stuff, but I've never had anybody question any of that. If you bring your handgun, they might say something, but they don't really care about what prescriptions you're taking. If you're trying to smuggle in a bunch of stuff, that'd be different. So we get back on the ship. I think mid-morning, something like that. So we're flying all night.
Like 7:30 in the morning.
7:30? Yeah. All right.
With all the war that's going on over there, this has not been structured.
Yes. And always is. Nope. Now, never say never, right? But, I will tell you this, I never one second felt unsafe. And it is much safer than it used to be. You know, back before they divided, you know, Jerusalem used to be divided up, half Jordan, half Israel, and you had snipers over this main street on each side of the road, and if anybody tried to cross the road, they'd shoot you. You know, so all that's done away with. So you've got some checkpoints you'll go through. Everybody knows how important it is for us to be able to spend money. And so they usually mess with the tourists. I've never heard of them do it. Exactly right. They all know that. You'll go through the checkpoint to Bethlehem. You'll go through the checkpoint to go to the Dome of the Rock. Other than that, you know, you're pretty much protected. And I'm telling you, where we're going, particularly to Jerusalem, Mount Olives, that kind of stuff, there will be more buses than you've ever seen in your life, full of people just like us trying to get to all this stuff. So, and you know, the Israeli army is ever present. They're around all the time.
We're flying
LL. Safe. Safe. Tel Aviv Airport is amazing when you're coming home, how they do all their security stuff. Nothing intrusive, but very, very well done. And so they take care of that stuff. Okay, y'all. Yes.
In the hotel, do we have to have a converter for anything that you plug in?
Yeah.